Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust,
and we're drinking brew for breakfast.
Okay, it's day three of Clash Week, and I can barely contain my excitement here. I don't think we want to do a lot of banter at the top of the show. No. We want to get into this one, right?
It's not often it's London Calling Day, Jim.
London Calling. I'm a little nervous because this is
a big one.
Absolutely one of the greatest albums of all time.
Mm-hmm. When did you first get it?
Funny you should ask, Patrick Foster.
Jim Lenahan.
I discovered this album my first semester, might have even been like first week at college.
Oh, wow.
So it was a little bit late because this came out in the U.S. January 1980. It was 79 in
December 1979. So it was kind of the last salvo of the 79s and the 70s, really.
It was 79, mm-hmm. but I believe if you look it up, mm-hmm. in the U.S. it actually came out in January 1980. And the reason why I know that is because it just made it under the wire to be included on all the like best of the 1980s albums. Mm-hmm. And it was Rolling Stone's pick for the greatest album of the 1980s.
Oh, interesting. So it was right there on the borderline, right?
But it was,
right as the decade was turning over.
It was
over.
Late 79 in the UK and then came out just like a couple of months later in
Certainly,
the US.
Certainly, yeah, right. Yeah. It was recorded and finished, you know, in late 1979.
Right.
So,
yes, but if right you look at the right album, it says 79.
Yeah, anyway. Right there at the turn of the decade.
That's
though.
Right.
It's fascinating. Yeah.
So I was, this would have been fall of 85 when I discovered it. My introduction to the Clash was through Combat Rock, which was 1982.
Me too?
Yeah. And then it took me then another 3 years before I really got into the rest of their catalog.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy on my dorm room floor at Indiana University who had this record, and he was like, you got to hear this, right? And immediately it was like, I started listening to it. It's so great. It is without a doubt one of my favorite albums ever. In fact, there was a period of my life in school, I had this on cassette, where I listened to this album at least once a week.
Mm-hmm.
At least.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what is it? 19 songs, and they're all great songs.
Yeah, they're all amazing.
And they're different, they're varied, but they, I think, you know, it's funny, because I think the greatness of this album, you know, one of the things that makes it so great is it speaks to me as an 18-year-old. It speaks to me as a 50-year-old.
Yeah.
You know, it's an amazing record.
It's a great point. And it's my favorite Clash album. Is it the best one? I don't know. Maybe you could make an argument that the first one is a better one because of the circumstances and the songs and the urgency.
And that was the next one I got into.
Yeah. and this one, I think, is my favorite one just because, as you said, at the time I discovered it, right? I got into Combat Rock first. And because I was working in a record store as an impressionable young high mm-hmm. school guy, there was older guys who were also high schoolers, but they were, you know, a couple years older that said, well, you got to get that.
Right.
Just come on, man. And, you know, I got it within a month of getting Combat Rock, and it soon became my favorite one. It was kind of a soundtrack for me for a lot of my high school years. But there's so much of it, it can encapsulate all those crazy moods of when you're, you know, 16 or 17 years old, right? There's so much to love.
Well, we got to hear something.
Yeah, and I think we talked yesterday about Julie's been working for the Drug Squad mm-hmm. and how it hinted at an expansive, different kind of sound for the Clash.
Mm-hmm.
This song, to me, was a really full-blown product of what they hinted at there.
Breakfast, roulette, got fell. Oh, no.
You've been drinking brew for breakfast.
Well, it's Rudy Can't Fail. And what is a Rudy?
I don't know. Some guy, right?
Well, so that's short for rude boy.
Yeah.
Right? Which in Jamaican parlance is sort of like a troublemaker, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Right. Somebody you wanted to be, in other words.
So the Clash's contemporaries would have been the Specials.
Yep.
You know, in England. And they
also
had,
managed by Bernie Rhodes for a while.
Right. Yep. And they had a message to you, Rudy, which was sort of a cautionary tale, right? But in this case,
calm
they're sort of
down.
It's sort of more celebrating the Rudy, right?
Isn't it great?
Yeah.
Yeah. The coolness about that whole lifestyle.
Right.
And for me, Jim, this is the best combination of the first record and the second record. So they had some production where the second record worked on production, and they had that rawness from the first album. And this one's just swung. Like, and also, were those horns that were happening back there? Like, that never happened with the Clash
horns,
before. And like this beautiful soul arrangement, right? So it was obvious obviously these guys were really deep. They knew records, like they knew music, right? And that came across, yet they didn't let it get in the way. They weren't snobbish about it. They were all still really cool and stylish. And the way Mick's voice piles on top of Joe's on some of those choruses or, you know, little phrases right there. You've been drinking brew for breakfast, right? It's amazing.
It's sort of in some ways like the Revolver of their discography, right? You know, sort of taking the band to another level sonically, musically.
And every experiment worked.
That's right. And that's the other amazing thing about it, because think about this. You know, we kind of worked backwards or didn't discover it in the right order, but I would imagine if you were already a fan of The Clash and you had the first two records, which are, you know, with some exception, you know, more, but more kind of straight on punk, you know, rock records. This is, you know, has a lot of the edges smoothed over. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, not as kind of loud and fast, but yet I don't think anybody felt in any way like they sold out with this record.
No, you know? it was really the record that delivered on the promise
that
they could be big and still be cool. That's, you know, that's what it was for me.
And the cover probably helped too.
Not bad.
So I don't think we have to comment on, you know, the album cover art, but you know, right there you're like, hey, that's pretty punk rock.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, talk about killing your idols.
That's a great pick. And there's a lot of songs on here. You know, it comes after songs like Jimmy Jazz, which is an
amazing song.
Amazing song. And, you know, like, who writes stuff like that?
Yeah.
And later on, you have things like Spanish Bombs,
yeah,
which has a whole different sort of, you know, flavor to it. Oh, man, there's so many. You know, the Card She, Lovers Rock. I mean, you know, it just goes on and on.
Well, the title track was pretty well done as well.
I didn't even, you don't even have to talk about it because everybody knows it. Everybody knows how great it is.
Death or Glory. How about that? That's a good song, right?
I love that too. Okay, so I just have to talk about a couple of songs just because.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear this.
First of all, I couldn't, you know, as you can tell, it was really hard to pick. Oh, Wrong Amboyo. That's another
one. Not bad.
Okay, it was really hard to pick which ones to play because, you know, for a 19-track double album, to have it be sort of, you know, as top to bottom great as it is, you know, it's really hard to even pick a couple of songs. But I just thought, here's what I thought. Let's just do this. The show we do is called Rock in the Suburbs. Let's have a couple of suburban-themed songs, starting with this.
My first ever feeling, that's how it's been can no longer shop at the Lee. I came in here for a special offer.
Lost in the Supermarket, yeah. You know, a commentary on, you know, sort of suburban proper British society, yeah. I guess, right? Apparently, of which, you know, Mick Jones is more of a product, right? He yeah. had more of a middle class upbringing as opposed to Joe Strummer. Mm-hmm. And Joe was kind of writing about what he imagined Mick's life
yeah.
to be like.
Yeah, yeah. Joe's parents were school teachers.
That's
so.
Right.
Yeah.
Starts with the chorus.
Yeah.
So the first line really is, I wasn't born so much as I fell out. Yeah. How great is that?
Oh, it's
right?
amazing. Yeah.
You know, already you're just set up for like the attitude of this song.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's Lost in the Supermarket.
Yeah.
And you think like, oh, that's kind of a funny song. But again, it has good commentary to it. And then it follows up with this next song. So that's Clampdown.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get to that part where it says, you start wearing blue and brown yeah. and working for the Clampdown. Because mm-hmm. the way I always took that to mean was those were like business suits.
Okay.
Right? So
right.
the idea being that you're part of this system, you're part of this, you know, capitalist system or yeah. what have you, and you're really then part of the problem, right?
Yeah.
You're part of the oppression,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, sort of going back to sort of like, that's what would happen to you if you, you know, kind of live the life that they want you to lead,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Grow up and wear
yeah, exactly. Down. You're yeah. a product, yeah. And for me, you know, hearing this record, when I did the second one after hearing Combat Rock, some of these lines were so heavy and so smart that they blew my mind, right? Just think about that song, taking off his turban. They said, is this man a Jew? Like, what the hell is right. that? How heavy is that? I don't understand what's happening, you know? And so that there was that about this record, you know? There was that depth and yet that swing and all this sprawling madness of a double album. Wait a minute. Punk bands don't make double
right.
albums. Like, that's weird, you know? It doesn't happen, you know? And here is one that's just... it's punk, but I don't know why, but I don't know how, but it still feels like a really shout along record that you can play really loud in your car, you know? And I loved all those things about this.
Oh, album. Completely. So I want to talk more about what I've learned about the recording of this record,
yeah.
but I think we should take a little break now.
Do that.
Cause we have to work for the Clampdown.
That's right.
So you'll hear this and then we'll come back.
Jim, I'm excited because I recently built something in my workshop, and it came out really good.
Is it a spice rack?
It is not a spice rack. That's my next project.
Okay.
But I built a website in there, and
yeah.
it's called suburbspod.com. It's our website.
It is our website. I see our names right there.
Yep. Got a picture of the boombox and our names and pictures. And
there's pictures of us recording the show.
A nav bar and things you can click on and... so basically, you can get some recaps of the episodes, right?
Does the nav bar serve drinks?
It does.
Oh.
But only if you click on one of the tabs here in the nav bar. So it's customized with our colors, which are black and orange.
Yeah.
And we've got recaps of the shows there where we write down the music we play, sometimes
That's
related
right.
ephemera.
That's right.
And I think one day in the near future, we might be posting other things like maybe some thoughts,
yep.
Some reviews.
I have lots of thoughts.
Yes.
I am ready to put them to paper. And then I think I just like scanned it in. And
there's a thing here on the side of your computer. Yeah. You put the paper in there.
Okay.
And it'll appear on the internet.
Oh, I'm excited. Yeah. This is great. So I would recommend that all of our listeners visit suburbspod.com.
Do it now.
So you were talking about, you know, the double album.
Yeah.
Here's what amazes me about this, Patrick, is when you read about the recording of this,
mm-hmm.
when they went in, when the Clash went into the studio to record London Calling, apparently they were like out of songs by this point. You mentioned how they put out singles and put out these other records.
Right.
They didn't really have anything. And
they
wrote this in the studio. Apparently first they did a little trick a lot of, I think some other bands have done since or maybe before, mm-hmm. which is to just play like a lot of cover songs.
Right.
Right. To kind of get themselves, you know, in the mood mm-hmm. for recording an album. These are the, you know, this is what we want the record to sound like or whatever. Get us inspired. They did that. And then they, you know, just kind of started writing in the studio.
Yeah.
And this is what they came up with. It's insane.
It's amazing. You know, they were in, like you said, a studio. They rented a rehearsal studio and they didn't have any songs or anything from sound checks. And they just started this place called Vanilla, whatever, recording mm-hmm. studios. And they just started writing songs in the studio. They would come in on a regular schedule and just started working.
They had separated from Bernie Rhodes by this point. So they had gotten kicked out of their old space.
That's right.
That he had set up. Yeah. They had a new space. And the other thing that they did, I think was funny, is when they actually got to like properly recording their original material, mm-hmm. is they would go in these like marathon sessions of like 18-hour days or whatever. But they would record for a while. Then they would apparently stop and play some football.
Yeah, that's right. They would go outside. They had like a little park or a school where they would like,
right?
Yeah, do five-a-side or something.
Yep. Yeah. And then they'd go to the pub.
Yeah.
Because of course that's what you do.
That's right. It's a working day, you know?
And then you go back and record some more music.
That's right. Yeah. So they really went at it like a job. It's fascinating, right?
Yes.
And didn't tell people where they were and didn't really have much communication with the label either.
You know, another thing that's said about London Calling, and it's very funny because it's called London Calling, mm-hmm. is this this album might have the most American influence on it to a large extent.
Yeah.
So you have songs like Hateful, mm-hmm. which have that Bo Diddley beat.
Yep.
You have Brand New Cadillac, uh-huh. which is
a cover
of a British artist, Vince Taylor, mm-hmm. doing American, you know, music, right? He was one of the only pre-Beatles British rockers, you know, that didn't really exist that much back then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that. So, and there are other examples as well. And then, you know, you have a song like Coca-Cola, which kind of speaks to the, you know, again, the kind of a Americanization of the world, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of the American influence on the music is in tribute to it.
Totally.
And going back to like sort of pre-British invasion.
Yeah, exactly. Think of Wrong and Boyo, as you mentioned, right? Where they start off with kind of Stagger Lee, right? That's an old sort of, you know, American blues spiritual that they kind of reworked and have been reworked. And they throw it in and they say, wait a minute, start all over again. And then they kick into, you know, the actual sort of song. But like you said, they were playing covers. You know, there's obviously another pretty famous cover on this record. You know, there's a couple of them, but there's also, gosh, I don't know, like you said, a spirit of America deeper than the rock and roll of Sun Records and Elvis mm-hmm. and Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, because there was that understanding of New Orleans and the blues and, you know, all that.
We really go back to Jimmy Jazz, another good example of that, right?
And I also think what made this record so galvanizing was it was really the first time you could hear Paul as a bass player mm-hmm. really standing out. He was totally buried on the first two records, and maybe on the first one he couldn't even play, right? And he's the cover star, Morrissey would say. But his bass is so soulful, and there's so much reggae and so much depth and originality to it. It's just really, and it's so well produced, finally, for the first time, right?
Right. So going back to, we all know sort of how amazing this record came out.
Yeah.
But then to think about what they started with, nothing.
Nothing.
And this is what they produced, makes it even greater.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
What an achievement.
Okay. So you had one more pick, and then I think we're going to hear something from one of our callers.
Yeah, I just really wanted to quickly talk about, you know, kind of something we just were sort of hinting at. The way they imbued, kind of swallowed, and really soaked up American culture for me is best exemplified by this song that they wrote about Montgomery Clift. Because, you know, we haven't talked a whole lot about the producer on this record, right, Jim? But it's important, you know, Guy Stevens, right? He was a total maniac who was brought in to produce this record. And he produced Mott the Hoople a little bit, right? Uh-huh. And he also was very influential as a R&B black DJ in England in the early 60s, right? He worked for Island Records at one point as a talent scout. But he really was the guy with the deepest knowledge of all things R&B at one time in England. You know, he influenced all the main songwriters. And he was... a maniac. He was an alcoholic, I think, at this point, by the time he produced London Calling. Just a total energetic, crazy guy. Like, there's some clips, if you look online, right, black and white, of him, like, throwing a chair across the studio to like, get the band fired up, right. You know? It's almost like Alex Chilton producing The Cramps, right? And, like, throwing stuff at him as they walked into the studio. Like, I'm going to hit you with a chair. But the band really responded to it. And at one point, apparently, he was reading a biography of Montgomery Clift, you know, the sort of drug-addled, ill-fated American movie star.
Right. And American influence,
yeah,
right?
And yeah. Joe grabbed it out of his hand, went and read the whole book, and came back with this song.
Where did I see this guy? In Red River. Or a place in the sun. Maybe a misfit. Head to the tongue. Recognize the dawn. He ain't got no shoes. Who's a thong? And everybody says he alright. And everybody says, what's he like? Everybody says you're looking funny. That's that Montgomery Clift money. I see a car smashed at night. Cut the applause and dim the light. Money's face is broken on a wheel. Is he alive? Can he still feel? And everybody says he alright. Everybody says shine a light. Everybody says it's not fine.
What a crazy song.
Isn't it amazing? And the Clash soaked up like old 50s movies and old Hollywood. You know, they live for that.
So the
stuff.
Right profile would be the way he wants to be
that's right.
Shot, right? Yeah. He wants to be filmed.
Right. But also his face is broken on a wheel and he calls for another roll of pills and, you know, give me my old movie stills.
I just remember, again, you know, as like an 18-year-old listening to this, like I had no idea what he's talking
about. Mind blowing.
But yeah. I didn't care.
Right.
Because the music just carries it.
Right.
So later you learn this stuff.
And once you do, you're like, wow, that was cool.
Yeah, exactly. Again, the horns, though.
Oh, fantastic arrangement. You know, the soul in those horns is...
Well, and the soul in Joe Strummer comes through there, too.
Yeah.
You know, the way the song kind of like breaks down there, kind of slows down, and he kind of carries it with his voice.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of almost James Brown-like in a little way. You know, that's quite a performance there all the way around, mm-hmm. Everybody involved. That's really great. Okay, so I mentioned we got a call to our Suburban Party Line about this album. And there's one song we haven't mentioned, maybe because a lot of, you know, I don't see it listed here. but everybody knows it. And the caller is going to talk about that. So before we get to that, please listen all week.
All day. Every day.
Please listen all week.
All day, every day.
to Rock in the Suburbs, because it's Clash Week, and we're going to talk about their five core albums.
Every day.
So we have two more to go, and you're not going to want to miss that.
No.
You're going to actually wish that they were released today so you could just binge listen, but that's not the case. You got to wait until tomorrow.
Got to wait to see how this comes out. That's quite right. Interesting.
That's right. Yeah. Tomorrow is a triple album.
Gets weird, man.
We just did a double. Now we're going to do a triple.
It gets weird. Might that need means, another red stripe.
That means three shots. Okay. Where was I going with this? Okay, yeah. So listen to Rock in the Suburbs. You can find it on any of your major podcast platforms. You can also find us at suburbspod.com. You can call this mythical suburban party line. It's not mythical. It's a real thing. It's
612-440-1984.
You can leave a message. You're going to hear a message from a caller in a minute. You can also email us rock@suburbspod.com. And let's get to this call, Patrick.
Okay.
Hey, my name's Michael Phillips. I'm a recent transplant to Virginia from New Orleans. I live in Tyson's Corner, which is neighboring Falls Church. My favorite Clash album has got to be London Calling. I was in college and I started going, you know, I was going out in bars in New Orleans and I kept hearing this song and I loved it and I'd run over to the jukebox to try to see what it was and it's called Train in Vain. So I started looking for the CD and I couldn't find it. And I was like, what is it? What CD is this on? It's, oh, it's on somebody. I finally found out. It's on London Calling. Once I bought that CD, it's like every song, there's like 19 songs on that CD. It's like every song is great. It's so many different styles, but, it's by far my favorite Clash CD. And I think it's one of the greatest, albums of all time. I put it in my top 10 for sure.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah. Thank you.
Northern Virginia resident.
Tyson's Corner. Yes. Shout out to America's next great city.
And so here's the thing. I have this CD and you have the vinyl or the CD of London Calling in your collection?
I have the vinyl somewhere. Yeah.
So
right over there.
What's the song he's talking about? I don't see it listed
here. No, it's not on my album either. It must be a misprint or something. I don't know what he means.
What's the deal with that?
It's not there.
So what's funny about Train in Vain is, first of all, when you hear that song, it's undeniably a great pop song.
Yeah.
First of all, you have to figure out the title of the song because that's not ever said in the song. So what is the song Stand By Me or Wouldn't Stand By Me? What is it? So first of all,
Stand By Your Man. I don't know what it's about.
What's the name of the song? Oh, somebody says it's called Train in Vain. What album is it on? I don't know.
It's on a Clash album.
So what's the backstory on that?
Well, it's interesting as far as I understand it that it was finished very late, but the band liked it so much that they wanted to sneak it onto the record. And, you know, most of the track listing and stuff had been sent already to CBS and they'd already kind of started doing marketing and planned it out. So they just snuck it onto the record without putting it on the cover because the band thought, well, let's just get it on. We don't care. And how cool was that? It's the first time in my life I'd ever been exposed to a hidden track, right? This is like 1983. And I'm like, wait a minute. It's on the record. It's one of the coolest songs. But it's not listed. They don't take credit for it. Were they donating all their money to, like, you know, the Boy Scouts? Like, why were they doing it? You know, this is the first time I'd ever heard of something like that, Jim.
But here's what's more insane about it. Like you said, it's a hidden track.
Mm-hmm.
Hidden track released as a single off the album.
Even better.
Like, I don't think that's ever been done before or since.
Yeah, it was really good.
It's really amazing. Good. Okay, so let's play out with a little Train in Vain. It's got Mick Jones fingerprints all over it. This is a pop classic. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And definitely we will talk to you again tomorrow. I mean,
I don't understand.
The song is so good that you want to at some point hate it, but you never can.